Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Dominoes, a game for thousands of years. But now, this.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 398 for the week of March 14th, 2022. I am low-wag-oriented oldie David T. Cole, and I'm here with Fall Wall Sarah D. Bunting.
I regret something!
Top-heavy toppler Tara Ariano.
Sorry, my boob knocked your shit over.
And brains and brawn, Brittany Luce.
Here, present, accounted for, and ready to dominate.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. We are back. Sarah is back in her seat. Welcome back, Sarah. We missed you last
week. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be back.
We are also here with a writer and the co-host of the recently relaunched podcast for Colored Nerds. You've also heard her on this podcast before. It's Brittany Luce.
Welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me again.
We're here to talk about Domino Masters, and so we'll get into it. But remember when we talked about the premiere of Lego Masters in 2020?
Yeah.
This is an extension of the
Masters
franchise, believe it or not.
Yeah. And I think they're renaming the Masters from golf. It's going to be called Golf Masters now.
Perhaps. Here, three-person teams compete to make wildly elaborate domino chains on a given theme. In the pilot, it's sports, and including several required elements in those builds. Host Eric Stonestreet and a panel of judges, actor and, I guess, mathematician Danica McKellar, retired NFL star Vernon Davis, and actual Dominist Steve Price preside. The teams get 16 hours to conceive and assemble their chains. Then they set them off. The judges judge, and the top two teams advance to the playoffs for the potential chance to win the $100,000 prize and the title of Domino Masters. Only the first episode is aired thus far.
Point of order.
Is what we're talking about.
Is the title actually, it's not Dominist, right?
No, I don't know.
What do they call themselves? Are they topplers or?
Chain builder? I don't know. I didn't write it down.
It sounds like Trekkie and Trekkers all over again. I'm not.
It could be. So before we get into it, let's do the Chen check-in. Go around the horn. Briefly tell the listeners, yes or no, should they watch Domino Masters, Brittany?
No.
Okay, Sarah.
No.
Dave.
Do you not have access to YouTube?
Yeah.
Yes.
Seriously.
That's kind of it. And we'll get into that too. It's too much. It's like, it doesn't need to be an hour long at all.
It doesn't need to be a network show.
No.
There's no reason.
It doesn't need to be.
No. It's another
it really
one. Like,
that's a good point.
Lego's Masters is the same thing. Like, they're one show away. Like, the next show is going to be Marble Races Masters,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Like, these are all things that YouTube, bless his heart, does better. I am coming to this medium with the expectations that I will see dominoes fall in a chain reaction.
Yeah.
YouTube is so much better of a venue for this.
Yes.
For variety, length, direction. Like, I bet YouTube doesn't give a crap about the people that are watching or judging.
We'll get
You're
into
just
that too.
Watching the dominoes and everybody's reaction to the dominoes.
Yeah.
And that is what this show is missing, is the excitement of all that.
Yeah.
Let's drill down a little bit. Brittany, the last time you were on, it was to discuss two other dumb game shows. Crime Scene Kitchen since then has neither renewed nor canceled, but Small Fortune has deceased. And after watching what Eric Stonestreet brings to this project as a host, justice for Lil Rel, right?
Justice for Lil Rel. The thing about this show is that, like, okay, there's two main gripes that I have with it, aside from the fact that it's an hour long and it needs to be about 90 seconds long.
Yeah.
Personally.
Yes.
That's just me personally.
Yep.
The first thing is, as you mentioned, Eric Stonestreet, charming enough guy. And I actually somewhat understand, like, why they selected the three hosts that they have, an athlete slash artist. They showed Vernon Davis, who I previously have never heard of because I don't watch sports, especially not football, because I do not understand it at all.
Nope.
But Vernon Davis, they showed him painting a football and he's like, I'm an artist. And I'm like, sure, of course.
Paint what you know.
Exactly. Paint what you know. And Danica McKellar, I did know that she was a mathematician and like a physicist or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, okay, that kind of makes sense. But, and like Steve Price being like the domino master, I get that he like really understands the form. But like they don't have chemistry. And also like, I don't really understand the role of Eric Stone Street. And then this other sort of like random, like almost like they're trying to make him into like a, like a 15% of a Gelman. That's like the prop master who they're kind of talking to sometimes.
Oh, Wes. Then there's this from Nailed It.
Wes. From what?
From Nailed It.
Yeah. Okay. See, I am not really familiar with Nailed It. I know people love Nailed It. I one day will watch it, but I mean, it's like, you know what I mean? You all know. It's like, there's so much stuff to watch.
It's another YouTube show, by the way.
It is.
It's
totally.
Just like this one. Even though it is way shorter, it could be shorter still. Same problem.
Yeah.
Sure could.
Yeah, they got Wes. And then they also have the off screen topple announcer who's like not seen.
Right.
And I'm like, there's too many cooks in the crime scene kitchen. Just kidding. There's too many cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I feel like I don't know who I'm supposed to be paying attention to. Like, it made me wish that there was like, I don't know, like on Project One Way, they like, or on Top Chef, there's like some, there's like clear roles for the host slash judges.
Yeah.
And there's also chemistry usually among those people, either interacting between the hosts and judge or between the judges interacting with each other. And I felt like that was missing. There was no clear roles. There was no chemistry between everybody. No disrespect to any of those people as individuals.
Yeah.
The other issue, my biggest issue, what makes Domino videos, which I love actually, so exciting is the fact that you don't know what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
When you see those first few dominoes fall, you don't know where it's going to lead to. You don't know how the story's going to unfold.
Yeah.
I was really surprised by how much they talked about storytelling, by the way.
Uh-huh.
But the fact that like I watch everybody put the dominoes together and then I watch them tell me repeatedly what's going to happen, it takes away some of the exciting, like the excitement of like the whole crux of the show.
Yeah.
And then like, and then it makes you wait like an hour to see all of it unfold. So for me, it's just like big no.
They're clearly padding, first of all, I think, because there's I agree that the various hosts at Elle have no chemistry. I am familiar with the Topple announcer's work. It's Joe Buck. He's a like known sports announcer guy.
And I forgot
that
about
gave
him.
Me like a chuckle at first.
Yeah.
To hear him do it. And he's clearly like he clearly thinks it's fun and funny.
Mm-hmm.
But that there's only so far that that's going to get you.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a lot of air, like Stone Street's delivery. There's just like joke, beat, and then, you know, a reaction shot from Vernon Davis that I guess is supposed to be funny, but because the joke isn't that funny, that isn't funny either. And it's not edited tightly enough.
Yeah.
But I mean, the fireworks factory is the topple. And when you get to the topple, like Brittany is exactly right that that is one reason there's no tension, that it's like you've just been told a gazillion times what's going to happen. And then if it doesn't happen, they have that little finger pokey doodad to make sure it at least partly happens.
Boy, they were pleased when they brought that out, weren't they?
No kidding.
Oh my God, we're giving you the finger. Like, oh my God, what year is it? Like, there's not just three channels. You have to do better than this. But the other problem is that they don't know what the focus should be, which is I want to see the actual build. I want to hear more from Steve Price about why certain things might or might not work. That it's like, oh, well, you know, you lose momentum on a curve. Like, oh, okay. Yeah, of course. That totally makes sense. But I would like to hear that during the build.
Yeah.
But once the topple starts, it's like there's no tension. There's no stakes. I don't like I'm not really sure what's being judged. And they keep cutting away when something cool is about to either happen or fail to happen.
Yes.
Like they just don't understand. The production does not understand how to make this exciting.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why it was attempted.
Yeah. This is the thing. And that I was yelling about when we were watching it. It was like, stop cutting away to show people reacting. Like, here's what it should be. It should be an overhead shot of the entire thing. So you can see it happening. And when you need to pull in for detail, show us like, here's where it's climbing up the stairs or whatever.
Or do a split screen.
And if you need to show us people's reaction, if there's like a tense moment or whatever, do it in a picture in picture so we can decide if we care to look at them or not.
Or guess what? Mic them and we don't have to see them at all.
Exactly.
Like, okay, but I will look at Vernon Davis reacting to things. I think he's hot.
Sure.
Everybody true. Else? That's fine.
Yeah. Okay, well, since we've touched on Steve, Dave, this is your chance to yell about how fucking terrible Steve is on camera.
Okay, wait. Really, I don't want to throw this guy Steve. Into the bus because this poor guy is obviously number one ranked dominist right now, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's the impression I get. And yeah. God bless him. He's a YouTube star in his own right
sure.
for setting up dominoes. He is obviously not built to be on television, certainly as a talking head on television.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I feel like at some point, somebody in the production either should have given him way more training, you know, how mm-hmm. to be on camera.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I feel like he needed a lot more coaching because it's sort of embarrassing for him. And I don't really think it's his fault because, like, I get it. Like, domino building and toppling is a very sort of solitary, introspective kind of thing.
Yeah.
And if you're an introvert like me, it kind of is like something that you could get into. And so I understand why he is really good at it and why he may not be a people person.
Uh-huh.
Boy, do mm-hmm. I understand that. But also, I wouldn't put myself on camera yeah. if I was as awkward as he seems to be
yeah.
in episode one. And I just, like, I didn't feel...
Yeah.
Sometimes I get angry at these people because, like, if I got that out of the other two guests, I would feel justified being angry at them because they're entertainers and they need to be entertaining.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
But this guy, I mean, I guess he's an entertainer, but you know what I mean? Like, he's
just a guy.
Enthusiast
yes.
more mm-hmm. than an entertainer.
Mm-hmm. And when he's talking about really expert nitty gritty stuff on the mm-hmm. subject, I yeah. felt like yes. he was fine because yes. he wasn't yeah. aware of the camera and he was like speaking his own language. Yeah. Whereas this like yuck yuck crap that they wrote for him.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
yeah. They're giving him Bruce Verlanche material and he's like, can't do it.
Yeah.
Not built for it.
No, it's true. Yeah.
Before we get off the judges completely.
Yeah.
The metrics by which they said they are going to judge when they came into this. I feel like that was actually another big strike against us because
yeah.
like I understand somebody at some point saying, well, you know, dominoes are, you know, things fall down. I guess that's gravity. Gravity is physics. Physics is math. Hey, I know. Let's get the girl from the Wonder Years in here because she's math and she's pretty. mm-hmm. And she comes in. She says, I will be judging you on how you use physics as a storytelling device. All right, let's put that to a side. And then the Vernon, the retired football player, says, I am here to engage with you on excitement. Aren't those just things you judge? Like, do they need to be called out and categorized
yeah.
and stick into buckets as metrics by which you will judge something? Like, that's all just good domino fall, me yes. like stuff. Like,
yeah.
Cool or nah.
Like, you either needed three domino experts on the judge who can play off each other and talk about what happened, or you really just need to say, look, we like this judge because he's funny or she's funny in the real world. And we think that would.
Or they're going to bring in a certain demographic. Like
sure.
we all live in the world. We know that's what's yeah. up.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
they kind of did judge sometimes on that. And it's like, Danica, what are you doing? Like, well, it seems that gravity is still in effect. And that when the dominoes toppled, you were using said gravity because we are all here on Earth. Congratulations. 2 points. Like, it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And the whole thing just felt like a 50-minute lead up to dominoes falling and then arbitrary everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. All right. Should we talk about the specific builds? Let's go with the losers first. Spoiler. Team Rocket Science, they picked hockey as their sport. It kind of tells right. you everything about their attention to detail when A, Gloria spelled goal backwards, mm-hmm. and B, declined to fix it when this was pointed out to her when there would have been time to fix it. Brittany, your yeah. thoughts on Rocket Science?
So with Rocket Science, I mean, I was totally distracted by the fact that goal was spelled backwards.
Same.
I did overall kind of like their story, I guess. But I don't know. I just felt like every single story was about sports in a convoluted way. But I did yep. think that they did an interesting job using like hockey pucks mm-hmm. in a similar way that you would use dominoes. But I mean, I don't know. I partially also judged some of the builds on like how the teams work together and also like how compelling of narratives the teams have. Mm-hmm. And theirs was pretty much I'm a rocket scientist, and me and my wife own a rocket supply company. And I was like, cool. I didn't know that those existed, but that totally makes sense. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you guys have a cool life. Yeah. But I don't know. I just didn't find them that spicy.
Yeah. Sarah, what did you think? Spicy.
I mean, I was glad there was like age diversity in, you know, with rocket science, but like I, as with the show overall, like even the builds that I thought were cool, like even the winning builds, I just didn't feel like we were getting enough background and enough like that scoreboard for the baseball team one. I was like, that is legit cool. That is my favorite. Okay. Yeah. Baseball is my favorite sport, but also like that looked really tough. Mm-hmm. But also like whether winner or loser, like I just feel like we weren't part of the process. So there was always this like lag between, it's like the beautiful drawings on Bake Off for the Showstopper. And then what you actually get sometimes, which is this sort of frumpy, they always call it rough and ready and they try to be nice because they're British. But like some of these things just look like, okay, I know they only had 16 hours and so on and so forth, but like this really is kind of the toppled it like situation. I don't know. Like I almost didn't feel like I could judge really the difference between winning and losing teams because we just didn't get enough information. There was just like, you know, Stone Street and various team members like making up musical numbers that were not funny. Like,
The rocket science team had a really shitty end, though. Like, everybody else's end, like, the end should have been, like, a 1,000,000,000 dominoes just exploded in your face. And
yes.
And theirs was a puck slid into a goal. No dominoes fell at the end of theirs. It was just like, your story has to end with an amazing domino event, not your story is somebody scored a goal, divorced from any domino action. Like, that alone. And nobody really brought it up. This is Domino Masters, right? Not, like, you know, let's retell Rudy in Hockey Masters. Again, what are the judges doing? Why are they here? Yeah. And why didn't the one expert say, like, you forgot one thing, dominoes?
Well, they did say that about the dominators. They made sure to say you used the fewest dominoes of all of them. That was the other team that lost.
Aesthetically, I really hated the areas. Like, they do their build, and then they kind of went into the prop room and filled the negative space with, like, just whatever sport-related gigas they had at the disposal. Like, here's a pinata baseball and all this sort of stuff. And it really just cluttered what we're here for, which is falling dominoes. And it just felt really half-assed as well. Like, you know, when you go to a wedding and there's the photo booth and they have those dollar store mustaches on the stick and the top hat that breaks the first time you try it on. That was what was on the floor.
That's true. But did they meet your spiciness requirement, Brittany? Because they did at least
spicy report, please.
The dominators. There was a little spat.
I mean, that helped a little bit. I'm not going to lie. That did help a little bit. I also felt like they were trying to give personality. I felt like they were trying to give personality.
Yeah.
But the other thing, though, I will say with them, even though I was I felt like they had some chemistry as a team, you know, to Sarah's point, like, not only did they not give us enough information about the process, they didn't give us enough information about the process. They didn't allow us to really see things come together.
Yeah.
It's missing that thing that's always really exciting on, like, Chopped or Top Chef, where you, so much can be revealed about the relationships on each team by watching them work together.
Yeah.
I felt like anytime, like, I would start to learn a little bit about each team, I don't know. Like, I just felt like they were moving on to the next thing. What's that other show that's on Netflix? Oh, The Floor is Lava. The Floor is Lava was really fun to watch because, I mean, it was just ridiculous. It reminded me of Legends of the Hidden Temple. Like, there was no plot. Like, it was just like, we're just going to put these people in a room and let them, like, crawl on furniture or, like, foam, you know, whatever. Like, the thing, though, is you were forced to just watch people try to work together to solve a really difficult problem. Mm-hmm. And that taught you everything you needed to know about their relationships. I felt like the dominators were people where I was like, oh, I wanted to know more about your relationships, but I didn't really get to see, you know, you guys work together in a way that felt meaningful to your relationships or meaningful to, like, the eventual build. But I did like the mini golf thing. I liked how they used the golf balls and they ended with fire, right? They ended with flames.
Yeah.
Yes.
Before we move off the dominators, I want to say, here's my alternate theory about why the drama that happened there, which is one guy was just like, just not being busy enough for the other guy. I mean, I guess that's, if you have to boil it down, I think that guy that was sort of standing around every once in a while and not moving and just looking at things and saying he has to do things at his own time, he had the coffee trots and he was trying not to move. And he couldn't say, dude, if I move, I'm going to shit my pants.
Interesting. Sarah, anything to add to the Dominators before coffee we move trots? On?
I don't think it was coffee trots. I think he wanted to go have a cigarette and couldn't say that on camera, actually. But same basic genre.
What I'm seeing here is we're all just bringing in what we, you know, our personal biases here.
I mean, I just don't. That spat felt totally inorganic, and this is another problem with this show. Like, show us the actual craft and don't create drama that's outside of them doing the craft. Mm-hmm. Just show them doing the craft, and if there's drama, it'll be there.
This seems like the kind of show you watch with your kid.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Yes. Like, this is a show, if you have like a 12-year-old kid,
they're
going to be apeshit over this if they don't have access to YouTube.
Yeah.
And I feel like that drama stuff, just axe it. Like, if it's not organic and it didn't seem to be, why do you have it in your show? Because the reason you're going to want to watch this is because you want to see people build and then destroy cool things.
Yeah.
Like, I had, when I was a kid, loved, obsessed with this toy called Domino Rally. It was basically this.
Oh, yeah. We had that.
Tiny little chiclet dominoes. Like, not full-size dominoes, but like one-quarter-size dominoes.
Mm-hmm. So hard.
And it had all these helper things that you could use to set up your rally.
Yeah.
Like cardboard stencils you put in this frame, and you put all the dominoes eaten, and then it kind of, the frame lifts it up, so you'd have like a nice serpentine line or whatever. Loved it. Very quickly appreciated that the ROI on the time you set up dominoes versus the time it takes to knock them down is like 1%, right? It crystallized that I love watching dominoes fall way more than I love doing anything with dominoes.
Yeah.
And this show should be that for people like me when I was a kid. And it kind of like really isn't. There's not enough action. Like, this should have been more of the setup and then more of the knocking down, multiple angles of big set pieces and stuff like that. It might have been better if they just gave one team more time and just had like a bigger, crazier thing. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't really know if the competition really matters, frankly.
No, it's true.
It doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
Show each team playing dominoes and talking shit. I'd rather watch that, frankly.
It is time to go around the dial. Our first stop is with Tara.
Well, I'm going to talk about Winning Time. Dave, give your impression of the Winning Time trailer we watched 5,000 times before everything on HBO.
Why is basketball so boring? Why can't basketball be like snorting cocaine with God?
Winning Time. Listeners of this podcast will know.
And then a scene from Airplane.
Listeners of this podcast know I'm not interested in sports. I do weirdly make an exception for pop culture about basketball, though. I watched Shut Up and Dribble on Stars a few years ago. I watched HBO's Kareem Abdul-Jabbar documentary a few years before that. Obviously, I love Air Bud, just kidding. But generally, when HBO debuts a prestige docudrama with a lot of wigs, I'm going to be interested. Plus, I love 80s LA culture. Plus, I needed a highbrow show to talk about this week. So I watched the first two episodes of Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, which is all that has aired so far. So this series is based on Jeff Perlman's nonfiction book, Showtime, Magic, Kareem, Riley, and the Los Angeles Lakers Dynasty of the 1980s. Showtime would have obviously been a better title for the series, but they couldn't call it that because Showtime is a competitor of HBO. And the subtitle pretty much tells you what the show's about. It opens with a short scene from 1991 in which Magic Johnson, who's played by Quincy Isaiah, finds out he's HIV positive. And then it goes back in time to 1979 and to Jerry Buss, played by John C. Reilly, controversially for Will Ferrell, which you know if you've read any of the press about this, any interview with Adam McKay, pontificating about what makes basketball so great, to the sleeping playmate he's in bed with because he's at the Playboy Mansion. And when she tells him to shut up, he starts addressing the camera directly instead and tells us he's buying the LA Lakers today. And then we later cut over to Lansing, Michigan, where Magic lives with his family, and he addresses the audience as well. Just beat Larry Bird in some NCAA thing, and he's the likely number one draft pick for the NBA that season. But will Jerry get all the money together in time to buy the team? Will the team's old owner turn Magic off when they meet by trying to cheap out on his contract offer? How does Norm Nixon, the current Lakers point guard, feel about his position getting usurped by a new hotshot? And will Magic decide he's not actually ready and put off the NBA for another year so he can finish college? I guess for some people, there's not much suspense about that last one. I didn't know. The trailer, which, as we said, we saw many times, makes this thing seem like it's got a Boogie Nights-ish level of fun and mayhem. But the first two episodes, at least, are, in my opinion, quite dry. You know from past Around the Dials that when people start talking about budgets and percentages and generally doing any kind of math, my brain shuts off. And there's quite a lot of that in the first two episodes. This may be why Adam McKay, who is an executive producer on the show and directed the first episode, felt he had to spice it up with a lot of style choices that I personally find more distracting than additive. Like when new characters get a Chiron, it'll be like Jerry West has never been happy or Frank Mariani has acid reflux, when we would be able to tell from the rest of the scene, Jerry's very angry and Frank is anxious. And when we're told that it's Jerry West's silhouette in the NBA logo, but do you think that made him happy? The silhouette logo was animated to yell, "No, I fucking wasn't," with just a black mouth drawn on the white figure. When we finally do get to see some basketball, Norm Nixon, who's played by Devon Nixon, Norm's actual son, challenges Magic to a one-on-one at a party, and a Bootsy Collins song plays on the soundtrack. Periodically, McKay edits in video footage of Collins performing the song at a concert for no reason. Like, it's not like he was at the party. Like, we're finally seeing some basketball in this alleged basketball show. Does he think we're going to get bored? Speaking of which, it's so light on basketball. The second episode only has one scene of a pickup game in Lansing. I assume there will be more once the NBA season actually starts. I imagine COVID was a concern for staging games, much as it is for actually playing games. But I feel like they could have figured out how to structure at least the pilot to include a little less discussion about real estate deeds and a little more of the sport. But it's obviously an interesting story, even to me. I wish I liked it more, but the directing and editing are so frenetic that I don't know if I'll be able to stick with it. The second episode's directed by Jonah Hill. He's not as ADD as Adam McKay, but he does have to carry over that style. And if you find it too frantic, a four-part documentary series about Magic Johnson called They Call Me Magic premieres on Apple TV Plus on April 22nd. So that might be more for you. I will check that out.
Or just watch the 30 for 30 about Lakers Celtics, which is really good. And I think even people who don't like basketball will become completely becalmed by that thing. Like, there's just something about watching Kareem skyhook that is like meditation on the wing. It's great. So,
yeah.
The real question is whether they're going to address the video game one-on-one with Dr. J and Larry Bird, one of my early video game obsessions, because every once in a while, if you got a really good dunk, you could break the backboard in the game, and that was amazing.
Ooh.
I mean, given the age of the people that made this show, it's possible that that will come up, but... Speaking of putting a hat on a hat, Survivor, I continued watching this season of The Amazing Race after we talked about the premiere with Jessica back in January. So I thought I might be interested to pick back up another 2000s era CBS reality competition. It was very weird. Is anyone here still watching Survivor in season 42?
I'm not, but I've been following the discourse, and you're doing God's work.
Well, I don't need to explain what it is. Everyone knows what Survivor is. This season is taking place in Fiji. They started with three teams of six players each. What I do need to explain to people who might be checking back in on it after a long hiatus is that the advantage situation is out of control. When I still watched, there were hidden immunity idols. That was like a relatively recent addition. I think Exile Island was a feature on the last few seasons that I watched.
Oh,
there's no
God,
Exile Island.
Yeah, that bitch.
But this season, there's a potential immunity advantage in the very first segment. Three players who've been sent to retrieve paddles so they can do the first whatever. It doesn't matter. They have to they find a letter that says they have to decide unanimously whether they each want this thing or not. They don't know what it is. They just know it's an advantage. There's a bunch of mud and fake blood there that they can use to make it look like the reason they took so long to get back was that whatever they were doing was really hard. And not that they were strategizing. And so obviously they all decide to take this advantage. I would explain it. I don't remember. The one guy in the group goes ham with the fake blood, even though he obviously does not have a wound. And a couple of times we hear his teammates express concern that he's bleeding a lot, but no later discussion among them about high not like needing fucking stitches, given how much blood was on him when he got back. But anyway, on the second day, each team sends one member on a trip to another island to hike and get to know each other. And then each separately decide whether they want to risk their vote for a chance to get two votes to use at any future tribal council. There's like a prisoner's dilemma aspect to this, too, where it won't work if they all choose the same thing. But again, right. It is so complicated. I don't remember the specifics, and we're not done. At Tribal Council, if you think you're in danger of getting voted out, you can choose a shot in the dark where you pick a little scroll that will either say you are or are not safe, regardless of what the votes say. I think it may have said that if you do this, you forfeit your own vote, but too much shit going on. I don't remember. And I understand that in season 42, anyone applying to be on the show has obsessively watched every season 1,000 times and decided which winning strategy they're going to try to do themselves. So the producers have to keep throwing curveballs at them. But by the time we got to Tribal Council, I didn't know who had what and how that might affect the voting. And after all that business, including the person who seemed like they were about to go taking a shot in the dark and getting a not safe scroll, what ended up happening was the person who seemed like they were going to get voted out got voted out. So it was all the material. And also, episodes are 2 hours long now. That's an hour too long. This isn't Married at First Sight. We don't need this much of these people. Like, I like Survivor in its heyday. I wanted to like this because I like to watch TV. I like to add a new show. But all of the tweaks to the game were what made me drift away in the first place. The situation now is so much worse. Oh, my God. Please tell me if you're still watching the show and if it's like a frog in a boiling water situation where it's like, no, they just added one at a time and now we're used to it and we can keep all the shit straight because I can't. For my plugs. I wrote about soaps at Decider. Dynasty is back for season 5 on the CW. So I wrote about that plus the other really enjoyable network soaps that have premiered this season, including Promised Land, Queens, and Our Kind of People, which are all great. And I also want to mention, Listen to Sassy, our sister podcast, has a Patreon at listentosassy.com/club. We are, one of the perks is that we do a monthly movie watch along on Zoom. And this week, this Sunday, March 20th, we are watching Troop Beverly Hills, which I have never seen.
A classic.
So yeah. Good. So if you want to get in on that, it's only $5 a month for that perk and many, many more. So listentosassy.com/club. We will link it in the show notes.
Brittany, what do you have for us?
I have like mixed feelings about Euphoria, the show on HBO. I have completely mixed feelings about the show. Some aspects of it I like, usually that has to do with the performances of the young actors on the show. They're just incredible. And Zendaya obviously is amazing on it. But I like struggle sometimes with like the storylines, where things are going, what's happening. So what I do is I wait until the season is over and then watch all the episodes in like a couple of days. So my fiance and I just finished the season either on like Friday or Saturday. And season 2 ends with this very meta sort of like play within the show that has been put on, produced, directed, written, and like, I guess the star of the play is this character, Lexi. Lexi is like a latent audience proxy in a way. I don't think she was originally presented that way. The person who really usually takes us through most of the action is the main character, Rue, as played by Zendaya. Mm-hmm. Through a lot of like voiceover narratives, we get to see a lot of her interiority. But she's also an addict and thus lies a lot. And she's like definitely an unreliable narrator. And the show, I believe, acknowledges that. But over time, again, the show is confusing and there's always all sorts of stuff going on that I do not understand. Uh-huh. But over time, this character of Lexi, who is Rue's childhood best friend and also the sister of another extremely divisive, maybe not divisive, mostly very hated character named Cassie. She's got a whole drama going on this season because she slept with her friend's ex, blah, 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 blah. I say all of that to say, even if you like don't really like or understand Euphoria, Lexi's play, which unfolds really over the last 2 episodes of the second season, episode number 7, which is called The Theater and Its Double, and episode number 8, which is called All My Life, My Heart Has Yearned for a Thing I Cannot Name. There's something really fun and exciting about like how much of a form breaker that those episodes are, mm-hmm. and how just truly shocking, ridiculous, not realistic at all. Lexi's play is. This play basically is all of Lexi's observations being like the best friend of this person who like is known throughout the school for having all of these addiction issues. And then also the sister of this person who's known throughout the school for, I'm trying to think of like a nice, like a decent way to say this about teenage girl, but just really putting herself out there.
Sure.
And yeah. And and also just like kind of being like a needy person who's super jealous of her best friend and kind of like, I don't know, Lexi lives within the shadow of her sister Cassie, who's living within this other character's shadow, who's like a super confident, actually pretty cool person named Maddie, who like, I mean, it's a whole thing. Anyway, Lexi's play is about the lives of all the teenagers on the show.
Right.
There's a ridiculous budget. The lighting is nuts. The stage design is better than things that I've seen on Broadway, I think. and I go to the theater fairly often. I was really impressed by Lexi's high school play. And also, like, her being the director and the star and the writer and the producer, essentially, it really, I don't know, it unlocked this part of her character that I thought was a really interesting depiction of ambition and creativity in a teenage girl. And I think that those two qualities can be found in teenage girls more frequently than I think is usually shown in pop culture. And I thought that like the depiction of Lexi was a really, I think maybe the most surprising and interesting part of the episodes that showed Lexi's play, which I think was called Our Life. They should have known actually when the title unfolded that it was actually going to be about all their personal business. She makes no, like, she makes no bones about the fact that every like ounce of dialogue, situation, costume choice, the actor's name, I mean, the character's names are totally lifted from her actual life, basically putting all of her personal business on display for her entire school. I hope I explained that well. If you haven't, I would say, like, even if you have a cursory understanding of Euphoria, or even just like read a couple episode recaps of literally any two episodes, because most of the characters are pretty static. like, I think that you could get a lot out of watching, I think you get a lot out of watching Lexi's play. It was just cool. Like, it just, I don't know, there was something about it that felt like, just weirdly Brechtian or something like that.
I've only seen the Euphoria episode of Saved by the Bell reboot, and I can't, I feel like I kind of track. I feel like everything there I could track.
Duly noted.
Yeah, that's what I've been watching recently. As far as, I guess, plugging myself, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can follow me at BMLuse, which is B-M-L-U-S-E, my last name. And you can also follow my podcast, which is at twitter.com/forcolorednerds. Also, we're on Instagram at forcolorednerds. And if you want to find our show, you can just go to forcolorednerds.fm. Also, unrelated to the fact that I just talked about an HBO show, I had to think about that very hard. I am co-hosting an upcoming podcast, actually, for HBO, which is called HBO Docs Club.
Ooh, I was so excited to see that.
Oh, yay! I'm glad you're excited. It was so much fun to make. But yeah, it's called HBO Docs Club. I'm co-hosting it with Ronald Young Jr. It is a podcast where basically me and Ronald watch six different HBO docu-series or documentaries and interview typically the directors, experts who can provide extra context, or even people that actually appeared in the documentaries themselves. And that premieres on March 21st. So if you're into documentaries, or if you're into listening to me talk, then I highly recommend that you give it a listen.
I'm gonna. Thank you.
Dirty Bunting.
So Top Chef returned for a 19th season a couple weeks ago. It is in Houston this time. I have not totally loved the first two couple of episodes choices, either in making these episodes team challenge based, like maybe just cast fewer people then or start eliminating them faster. Or in whom they chose to eliminate early on. The first eliminee was from my neck of the Jersey Woods, and you don't get a lot of Garden Staters on that show for whatever reason. That, like, everyone's either from a part of Brooklyn I'm also not hip enough to live in, or they're just like, well, all they know how to cook is pork rolling and cheese, like, guys. Anyway, I especially do not love that the show slash Bravo have not addressed the accusations against season 18 winner and alleged sex pest Gabe Arales beyond basically disappearing him and not speaking about it. And then Tom Colicchio commented on the matter to his detriment to the Daily Beast recently. That was a disappointment. He basically opened with, well, Gabe's not as bad as some other chefs. It was only sexual harassment. I'm paraphrasing, barely. And then he went on to say that the woman with whom Gabe had a, quote, consensual affair, which I would say it's debatable. It isn't. It was the workplace, and he is alleged to have exploited the power dynamic after the relationship ended. Anyway, Colicchio's like, well, we haven't heard from this woman, as though the onus is on the victim of misconduct to source the information for fucking Tom Colicchio. Colleagues, I know you know better than that shit. Do better than that shit. In any event, my hope is that Padma, whose badassery is growing over the last few years and who is still like having a great time and seems to be stoned, but like in a fun way, blows up everyone's spot and dares the network to consequence her for it. But I mean, it's still a good watch. I don't want to be disappointed in Tom Colicchio. So do better, everyone. If that whole thing is leaving, sorry in advance, a bad taste in your mouth, and or you want a fairly fun binge watch that you can have on and watch with most of the family, although there is some swearing, give Fast Foodies a try. Top Chef vets Kristen Kish and Jeremy Ford and Iron Chef winner Justin Sutherland invite a guest onto each episode. The guest brings their favorite fast food, and the chefs then compete over two rounds, trying to replicate the dish exactly in the first round and then putting their own twists on them in the second. The guest declares a winner who takes home a hideous championship trophy reminiscent of the Sacco on the League, if anyone remembers that thing. And then the other two have to do a dumb, quote, consequence. I watched the James Vanderbeek episode from the first season, and it's silly and speedy, and you can pay as close of attention as you like. The chefs are all charming and easygoing. The Beak absolutely understood the assignment and played up the heartthrob bit that I thought was going to be stupid, and it was, but then it came back around to being funny. It's on True TV, so it is way overproduced and not quite as funny as it thinks it is, but the show knows how to shoot the food, and the vibe is fun and shaggy with everyone sitting around playing a Beak trivia drinking game with brown liquor. 23 minutes, zero stakes.
Nice.
The second season is in the home stretch on True TV, but you can find it on demand if you still have a cable box, and if you don't, the whole first season is on HBO Max.
Nice.
For my plug, Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs is coming back in a couple of weeks. You can vote on the America's Damp 40 season, WMST Moist FM. What are the soggiest songs of soft rock? You can go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/mastess. It's all public-facing polling. Please help us choose a top 40 of damp songs of the 70s and early 80s. We're going to have a good time.
Like songs about dampness or like November Rain?
No, like Player, like Baby Come Back, like Cool
right.
Night, like a lot of Art Garfunkel, mm-hmm. Wailing. Understand.
All right, guys, on the next Extra, Extra Hot Great, it is Important TV Kates and not, as my document currently says, Important TV Kites, although we could try that sometime. For an extra level of difficulty, Sarah has declared that we cannot use Catherine's with a C or Catherine's with a K or no Katie's. It's got to be Kate or get the fuck out, apparently, is what is happening. That's there. Right.
Yep.
And then on this very show, EHG Prime, next week, it is the Game Time Tournament featuring 9 Patreon listeners battling out over 4 games to crown an eventual winner that is free for everybody, even though it features our Patreon supporters. Check that out next week. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Tara. Holy cats. Holy cates.
Rami is a half-hour dramedy on Hulu, both by and about its eponymous protagonist. Comic Rami Youssef developed the series based on himself and his family, and he plays the titular role. However, his character barely sets foot in the episode we're going to be discussing today, season 1, episode 7, titled Ne Me Quitte Pas. It's not at all a typical episode, but I hope I can still convince you that it's special enough for an induction into the canon for the following reasons. Number 1. Not about Rami. I realize this sounds like a strange point to make in favor of this episode. Obviously, Rami is not a completely unbearable character. I wouldn't have continued watching a show about him. But as in many single cam comedies and dramedies, Atlanta, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Veep. Story on Rami, the show, is often driven by its protagonist's selfish, jerky behavior. Episode 6 of the first season, titled Refugees, already took its focus off Rami to spend some time with his younger sister, Dina, played by Mae Kalamaui, and tell the story of how sidelined she feels in her family compared to the brother she thinks her parents favor. Namakit Pat takes us inside the life of Maisa, Rami's mother, played by the great Hiyam Abbas. While there's no question that the show knows how insensitive, inconsiderate, and generally trifling Rami can be, centering other characters from time to time helps to clarify his function within the larger story of his family and community. It also gives the viewer a break from episodes in which Rami does something selfish and jerky and then feels bad without necessarily learning anything from the experience. Number 2, it's a thoughtful portrayal of loneliness. Maisa is in a transitional phase of parenthood. Though her children both still live at home, they are grown up now, involved in adult pursuits. She feels that they don't consider her or her feelings enough, and from the evidence of this episode, she's got a point. Early on, we find her making a huge pot of stew for dinner. I don't know what it is, but I saw rice and beans in a tomatoey sauce. It looked really good. I'm in. And setting the table. And then her husband, Farouk, Amr Wookhead, seemingly as an afterthought, texts her that he won't be home for dinner. Rami wanders in for the one and only scene in which his face is even on camera, taking the keys to Maisa's car so he can blow off her lovingly prepared dinner to play grab ass at his friend's diner. Maisa objects in clip 1.
Habibi, I made all this food, Yani. I'm going to throw it in the garbage.
It's not a big deal. Dad'll eat when he comes home, okay?
No. Your dad is eating at work. He just sent me a message. And your sister, Allahu a'lam wainha, she doesn't even answer me anymore. I don't know where she is.
Ma, she's at the movies, all right?
And why do I have to know this from you? Why she doesn't tell me? Why doesn't she call me?
Because she's in the movie. You can't answer your phone when you're in the movie. All right, you know that. It makes a glow, all right? Love you.
Rami, habibi.
What?
Can you help me, please?
Ma, I gotta go. What?
I think I have a real problem with my Facebook. Look, I don't get any likes. I think the post is not going through.
Ma, it's going through, all right? If it's here, they can see it, all right? Your friends will just like it when they log in. All right, I gotta go, all right?
After Rami has left, Maisa scrolls to one of her own Facebook posts and, breaking all our hearts, likes it herself. When Farouk gets home later to smoke his hookah and watch an Arabic soap opera, Maisa comments that she's been thinking of joining a new gym in town. She can improve her fitness and meet some new people. Without looking away from the screen, Farouk says she's too old, the place is a scam, and she could find the same workout on YouTube for free. She does try the next day on her iPad, but ends up sitting on the floor under it smoking instead. When Rami makes his second and final appearance in the episode, it's on the phone, failing to bring the car home as promised so that Maisa can take it to the supermarket. Instead, he sends a rideshare car to get her, and while Maisa is initially anxious about a stranger knowing their address, small talk with her driver changes her feeling about the service. Clip 2.
If you get thirsty, grab a water bottle. Got mints, too.
Wow. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I have a gum?
Oh, yeah, please. They're good. The peppermint ones are nice.
I love those. Thank you.
You see this shit? You see this lady texting while driving? Breaking the law. That's New Jersey law. You can't do that. I'm over in Morristown. They're not any better over there.
Wow. Isn't that too far?
I mean, I go where the rides take me. Part of the job.
You do this every day?
Yep. Yeah, this is it right now. I mean, I was working on getting this small business thing going. Always talked about it with my dad before he passed. I mean, this is way better. Yeah, I mean, food industry is a killer anyway.
Sorry about your loss. May God give him comfort in his grave.
Yeah, it's all good. You know, life has its path. It brought me here. You know, I mean, this was perfect. Never know what's next. Never know who you're going to meet, where they're going to take you. Every day is an adventure.
So you pick up strangers all day?
Yeah. I mean, they start off as strangers, but sometimes they become friends.
Wow.
Smash cut to Maisa cleaning the car inside and out, stocking it with amenities, mounting her Lyft light on the dash, and zipping off to pick up her first customer, a young black woman. Clip 3.
Oh, no.
You're so pretty. Oh,
Thank you. Nice face. Nice straight hair. Better than afro. You know, I think if you add some extensions to your hair, you'd be perfect. You know, long, nice hair like Beyoncé? Wavy.
Wow.
Oops, that's not a five-star ride. Maissa's next passenger berates her for coming down the street the wrong way, so it's not a great first day. When she sees that her account is at risk of being deactivated due to her low rating, she comes up with a way to differentiate herself from other local Lyft drivers. But it turns out passengers would rather have a neutral-smelling ride than one where their driver pushes homemade food on them. Maissa is definitely meeting new people, but she is not making friends. Number three, it takes Maissa's sexuality seriously. Maissa has just bitterly dumped all the snacks she made in a trash can and is back in the car when she gets another ride request. Sidebar, she throws out not just the food, but the two perfectly good Rubbermaid containers the food was in, by the way.
Thank you.
Replacing those is probably going to cost as much as she made driving. But anyway, the new passenger is Jacques, played by Jean Brassard. And when he notices that she's smoking, having apparently given up on shoring up her rating, he asks if he may do so as well. She answers him in French, having heard him speaking it when he got in. Jacques then proceeds to flirt with Maissa pretty hard. She has a beautiful voice. She looks like a movie star. Through their banter, we learn more about her. Her family's from Palestine, but they lived in Paris for a while, followed by Egypt. Jacques has been to Egypt a few times on work trips and vastly prefers it to the U.S., which he calls a shit place. She can't possibly like it here. Maissa seems charmed by Jacques' unapologetically superior attitude, even as she flirts back that he shouldn't be so negative. The drive is suspended so Jacques can stop and buy more cigarettes and to muse. And since this is basically all in French, I'll just transcribe the subtitles. This is his story. You ever ask yourself, what the fuck am I doing here? I mean, there's big life questions, of course, constantly reevaluating our roles. That's natural. What I mean is, have you ever found yourself doing something truly simple yet truly odd? For example, it's 3 a.m. and suddenly you wake up with a specific idea and make a sandwich you've never made before. Turkey, peanut butter. Doesn't make any sense, of course, and just as you're about to eat it, you notice there is a small cat, yes, a little cat, staring at you right outside the window. You cannot help wondering, does this cat know how odd this sandwich is? And then you start to really think, in this precise moment, is there someone else in the world having this exact experience? Listen, 7 billion people, infinite possibilities. Is anyone else at this moment eating this sandwich feeling judged by a cat? You've had more than cigarettes today, I'm sure of it, Maissa laughs. And Jacques says, clip four.
Je suis un petit peu fucked up.
When Maissa finally drops Jacques at his hotel, he asks for her number, clarifying when she hesitates that it would be for rides, so they don't have to go through the app. By this point, Maissa does seem like she's down for rides with Jacques and agrees. At home that night, Maissa quietly yearns for her youth, looking through old photos and trying to fish for a compliment from Farouk. Not even about her looks now, saying something nice about a 20-year-old picture seems like it would be enough. But Farouk darkly replies, God gives us our bodies and he takes them away little by little. Hey man, you didn't have to tell it like it is. Also, who would know this better than a handsome man in his late 40s who's being forced to cover his full head of hair with a bald cap for this prominent TV role? The next afternoon, Jacques does text to schedule a ride at 8 p.m. And while Maissa gets dressed up for it, we hear Jacques Brel singing Ne Me Quitte Pas. Nina Simone covered the song in English. I'll link those English lyrics in the show notes, but the title means Don't Leave Me. And here's an excerpt. We've often seen fire flowing again from an ancient volcano considered too old. It's said that there are fire-scorched lands that yield more wheat than the best April. And when evening comes with a burning sky, the red and the black, are they not joined together? Don't leave me. I think I get it. But when Maissa has arrived at Jacques' hotel room and popped the trunk for him to load in his suitcase, clip five.
Bonjour, Maissa.
Bonjour. Je vous connais?
No, but I know all about you because my husband said that he finally met someone besides me who is sensible in this country. This man hates everyone, actually everything, but he comes back to the hotel yesterday smiling and he says, I met this Egyptian in New Jersey who speaks French. And she let me smoke in her car.
C'est une anomalie quand même, non? Je me trompe?
Thank you for picking us up. I'm Marion, by the way.
Enchantée.
At LaGuardia, Jacques gets his suitcase out and taps on the back window to say goodbye, but Maissa speeds off before she has to listen to whatever he might try to say, and the episode director, Shireen D'Abbas, doesn't bother to cut in a close-up of Jacques reacting with confusion or regret or whatever, because this isn't his story, it's Maissa's, and we need to stay with her while she sobs in the car, stalks into a White Castle, fights with the bathroom door, scrubs off her makeup, hates herself for her fantasies, and then eats her feelings. With half a slider barely chewed in her cheeks, she glances up and sees that a kid outside has a cat on his shoulder, and that cat is absolutely judging her. Living in patriarchy, we've all seen countless portrayals of women who dare to have sexual impulses even if they're over the age of 35. I certainly didn't expect this show to treat Maissa as though she were as ridiculous as Mrs. Roper from Three's Company or Mona from Who's the Boss, but I also might not have expected Rami Youssef, who wrote this episode and who had just turned 28 when it dropped, to have so much empathy for a woman at Maissa's stage of life. The slider gorging is funny, but her hopes for where her friendship with Jacques might go are not. And speaking of Jacques, boo, turns out you can be a fuckboy at any age. Number four, it doesn't pretend to solve its character's problems. Back home that night, Maissa sulks on the couch in front of a movie she and Farouk have watched many times and is so distracted that when he speaks to her, she answers in French. Farouk asks why she stopped speaking French and she snits back, "No one understands me." But even though he doesn't know French, he always loved hearing her speak it when they first met. He would purposely make her mad because it was so sexy when she would curse him out in French. The two share a charged look and then pounce on each other. And this is especially brave of Maissa since she's probably quite bloated and gassy from her White Castle feast. She delights in talking dirty to him in French, and the encounter is over quickly, just in time for Farouk's favorite part of the movie, which he gleefully rewinds, oblivious to her dismay. As exciting as it was in the moment for Farouk to see Maissa as she was when they first knew each other and for them to connect again, this one frantic scramble hasn't reset their relationship. We close on Maissa alone again on the porch, smoking, and then smiling as she receives a new Facebook friend request. Is it from Jacques? Will he try to get a ride the next time he's in town without his wife? Does his wife even care if he fools around? Would Maissa pursue such an opportunity? We don't know any of that, but what we have learned from this time with her is that Maissa has needs that aren't being met. She started the episode lonely, and she still is, though the interlude with Jacques may have convinced her to seek out new ways to feel more alive. Number five, it loves New Jersey. There are other episodes that, to my outsider's eye, are more richly evocative in New Jersey, but even the tiny touches here make it clear how much Youssef and his creative team want to show the town at its most charming. The little downtown with a new fitness studio? Cute! The streets Maissa's first rideshare driver takes her down? Homey! When we see Maissa's car parked outside Maria's deli while Jacques is inside getting cigarettes, surrounded by a scattering of fallen leaves at, I want to say, about 4:45 on a Saturday, the entire frame gave me a jolt of nostalgia for fall in the Northeast. I mentioned Atlanta earlier as an example of a show built around a flawed protagonist. Another element it shares with Rami is this specific and loving sense of place. Insecure and Reservoir Dogs, same thing. Among many other shows. Number six, and finally, it loves smoking. Look, Maissa falls for Jacques' whole deal for a lot of reasons, but even I, a lifelong non-smoker, can see the appeal of their first afternoon together, driving around safe, quiet streets, smoking and talking shit. Who wouldn't be seduced by the possibility of being, or at least feeling, 17 again? And who better than two French citizens to make smoking look cool and sexy as hell? That was all pandering for Sarah. Rami could have just been a very good show in its genre, but the depths of its talent on both sides of the camera is what elevates it to greatness. And I think this showcase for, arguably, its very best actor proves it. I hope you agree and that you will vote it into the canon. And that is the end. Brittany, you chose this from our list. Please start us off.
I was so happy to see this on the list. I love the show, Rami. When I first watched it, I think it was right after the second season had come out. I think it was during the pandemic, and my fiance and I just, well, we didn't have anything to do. And so we started watching, I think we watched maybe both seasons in a day, because every episode was only like 30 minutes. It goes by so quickly. The writing is really good. The performances are great. But this episode sticks out as one of my favorite of the entire series. Additionally, another really good episode was one that shows that follows, like a bottle episode that follows Rami's sister. It's also really good. That sort of like gets into her as like a younger, like Muslim Egyptian woman who's American in New Jersey and like wants to do things her brother does, but her family won't let her. It was really interesting to see though, so much interiority for a, like for like, a female immigrant character who was in like her 50s, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
It's just such a rarity on American television, even though it's an experience that many people are having. And I think the interiority thing was the thing that actually got me the most. It's rare to see like a woman thinking and feeling in some ways sort of uninterrupted, rather like her activity, her piece was interrupted repeatedly throughout the episode.
Yeah.
But us following her, our attention was on her the entire time. And that also was kind of rare. There were so many moments from this episode that really stand out. But I think none of them could work if you don't have the performance of Hiam Abbas. She's so good as Maisa on this show. Like, the character of Maisa is so far away from the character of Marsha, who Abbas also plays on Succession, which comes on HBO, who is like cunning and mysterious. And like, I think Marsha would make a great spy or hit woman. Maisa has a completely different energy. But there's like, I don't know, almost like it's interesting. So many, you see every other character on screen see Maisa as somebody to serve them. We see her like her daughter less so. I think her daughter more so feels like a fear of growing up to become Maisa. Mm-hmm. And she wants to, because she sees how everybody thinks of her as someone who's supposed to serve them. You see Maisa's husband feel that way. We see Rami act that way. And so it's interesting when we see Maisa get with the French guy when they're like driving around, because it seems like, oh, this is somebody who's actually seeing her as an individual.
Yeah.
But then when he loops back around to ask her for a ride, and we find out it's to LaGuardia Airport with his wife, it's not just disappointing because he was so flirtatious with Maisa. It's disappointing because he still sees her in another role of service as his driver. And not that there's like, obviously, like there's an explicit like driver passenger relationship, like inherent in using services like Uber or Lyft. But he, as the passenger, is the person who sort of like broke the boundary that's usually inherent in that relationship. Mm-hmm. He's the person who tried to give it added meaning,
yeah,
and more depth. And to see him just sort of kind of like rescind that and place her back in the role of, as his wife was quoting him as saying, an Egyptian who speaks French in New Jersey. All those things are technically true, mm-hmm. but Maisa is so much more than that. And I think that the intimacy of Maisa and Jacques' interaction showed so much more depth than that. It deserved so much more respect than those words. And you kind of see her snap back immediately into sort of remembering how other people see her. We see another moment like that with her husband, after they have sex, which seems good. Like, it was a pretty good scene. I thought it was really well choreographed, mm-hmm. and it felt organic, and it felt like something that was real for a couple who had been together for decades.
Yeah.
You could tell that they have like a shared intimate language of like, they kind of have to give each other a couple of the right looks, and then it's off to the races, mm-hmm. and things are moving quickly, and they're hitting all the right notes. Right. And then immediately she's again snapped out of that. I don't know. It's like when they were connecting and having sex in that moment, it felt like they were in sync, like they were enjoying something together. But then when her husband turns back to watch the movie, you can tell that she feels used somewhat to a certain extent again, but like the expression on her face is not the same defeat that she had when it came to Jacques. It's not the same disappointment she had looking at Facebook or talking to Rami. It's kind of like she's almost humored, but there's like a resignation to it, like where she knows, okay, yes, of course, like back to square one again. This is where I am. It's like that tiny little shift in her expression that makes the performance so incredible. And then then at the end of the episode, when we see Maisa on the porch having that cigarette, looking at Facebook, kind of smiling to herself, staring off, into the night. That moment is so earned. Like, she doesn't feel completely downtrodden. It feels like something has been lit in her. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like, that episode is one of my favorite episodes of television, I think, of like the past 5 years. And it was such a joy to rewatch it. It's anchored by the performance, but The story itself is so contained and the characters are so clear that even if you had never seen an episode of this before, even if you just showed it to someone, any random person who never even heard of Rami, it could stand alone as a short film. And it's really hard, I think, for bottle episodes to accomplish that. It's really hard for a television show to accomplish that, period. Also, something I noticed when I was just like looking up stuff about the episode, it's directed by, I looked up how to pronounce your name.
Shireen Dobb. Right, but,
yeah, Shireen Dobb, who's a Palestinian-American filmmaker, who also directed her in her first feature, Amrita. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I wonder, like, how much, like, the intimacy that they had as, like, actor and director came through on Rami, the television show. But, yeah, I loved it. I'm so glad it's going to be in the canon. And I think we'll see. But my vote is yes.
Sarah.
I had never watched Rami before. This really was a short film. And it brought to mind something that I say a lot, just about like watching European procedurals or what have you, that and US television is getting a little bit better about this, but when I say that, it's like, well, there's one example and it's The Good Fight. But anyway, about like not sort of de-dimensionalizing women over 35 who have like pores and cellulite and just being like, well, we're going to put judge's robes on her and that's enough. Like we don't have to think about the interior life or desires of a woman who is old enough to be president, because that's not interesting. Like, finally, that is starting to be considered interesting and it's long overdue. But there's also on this show, this just sort of broader thinking about what is beautiful, not just in terms of like someone's age or someone's wrinkles or whatever, but also that sadness or like rue can also have a beauty to it. You know, as a New Jersey native, you sort of get used to looking out a car window at the turnpike and finding a sort of terrifying beauty in the big blue dinosaur shiploaders. And, you know, like that's just part of being from New Jersey is like, that's hideous, but it's home. So I thought that it did a really good job of, first of all, being, you know, in New Jersey and about New Jersey, but not being defensive about it, which is difficult. And even The Sopranos did not pull that off all the time. It had a sort of acceptance of that loneliness and sadness can make beautiful narrative, but also that a lack of movement is sometimes story also. And it put me in mind of a couple of my favorite episodes of Atlanta, in that it is sort of a short film in which a lot of things seem to happen, but then there's no resolution. Mm-hmm. And the ability to sort of be content with that as a storyteller and just stop before telling us everything and let us fill some things in or not, or understand that, you know, art isn't always an exact, it's not always improving life. Sometimes it's just reflecting ambiguities, that I thought that it did a good job of that, but without, I don't know, kind of stepping back all AMC is what my notes say and being like, look how ambiguous we're leaving this. Like it just is. I think that we need to have some justice for all the food that was ignored or thrown away in this episode. I could almost smell the car and I was like, but lady, like, I know you just ate, but Jesus, like get it to go.
Yes.
We saw her cooking and it looks delicious. Mm-hmm. And she's like, it's vegan. And the woman's like, phew. I'm like, oh no. like the judge who hasn't stared out the window of a White Castle and seen a judgy cat in a backpack. I ask you. That ridiculous conversation, that like flirty conversation that really is that conversation that you have when you first meet someone and it's like, let's just be like surrealist and weird and see if the other person goes for it. And then her utter just falling apart inside and then feeling ashamed of herself for believing it was just really well done. It was not the easiest half an hour that I've sat in front of in a while. I did not actually want to keep going because I needed to just sit with this for a minute and feel sad about my face. But yeah, it was it was fascinating. And like, what a, I mean, of all bottle episodes for this show to do, I've never watched it before, but I do know about it. So, so much to think about, like so much more to talk about than the runtime of the show. So I should shut up, but, excellent presentation.
Thank you.
By the way, David T. Cole.
All right. I also enjoyed it, but since Tara's opening line about all the food that she, made at home that went to waste and listing a couple of the ingredients, I went down a rabbit hole trying to figure out what that food might be.
Yes.
And let me just tell you about my new food obsession, the national Egyptian dish of koshari, or perhaps kosheri, which is a widely popular street food mix of Egyptian staples, mixing pasta, rice, brown lentils topped with a zesty tomato sauce, garlic vinegar garnished with chickpeas and crispy fried onions, often served with sprinkles of garlic juice, garlic vinegar, and hot sauce.
Hell yeah.
Does that not sound like the quintessential David T. Cole meal?
Yes.
That's everything you love.
Spicy and farty as hell.
The last time this happened was when we did the Anthony Bourdain
Parts unknown.
I'm trying to remember what country it was, but they had a street food.
It was Senegal, wasn't it?
Senegal, yeah. It was a Senegalese crepey kind of thing involving lentils and chickpeas and stuff like that. And I was thinking, is it possible to like just book a flight, go there, eat, come back? Like that, I would be happy with that if that's what it takes. This sounds delicious. I immediately went on to DoorDash just to see if there was any, like, because you can search by dish to see if anybody, no, not here. I bet Houston would have it, though.
I bet.
Yeah, yes. I bet they would.
Houston. Yep. Anyways, it looks delicious. I'm very happy for this show to bring this to my attention. I don't think I'm going to stop obsessing about this until I get it in my mouth. So well done show for that.
Yep.
And also well done show for everything else everybody's been talking about today. I really don't have anything to add, so I'm just going to take my time to talk about kosheri, which sounds amazing.
EHG Recipe Club will reconvene next week.
Let's put this to the official vote. Brittany, what say you?
I say I. Yes.
Sarah?
It's full of young people there. Yes, definitely.
All right, so that's 3-4-3, so... That means, Rami, season 1, episode 7, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Who has this week's winner?
I have the winner. And speaking of the good fight, it's the good fight. Because for season 6, the show has cast Andre Brower. And
ooh, hot damn.
Finally, Alan Cumming will be returning to reprise his role as Eli Gold at last. I'm very excited.
Hot bamf. That's a deep. That's not that deep. But somebody's going to enjoy that joke. And loser of the week?
Well, I just want to have a sub-winner because it came out after we... picked this week, but Abbott Elementary renewed for season 2. Hooray!
Oh, wonderful new show. That's awesome.
And now the sad news, loser, is The Babysitter's Club, the Netflix show. It is canceled after 2 seasons. Oh no, this is breaking news for Brittany.
I loved this show.
No.
See, so good.
I guess I was part of the problem because I'm like half a generation too old to have read those books. So I never watched the show, but I certainly understand the pain of having a show canceled at Netflix too soon, Glow. So I stand in solidarity with the Babysitter's Club fandom because when this came out last week, people on Twitter were absolutely bereft and heartbroken. So I'm sorry, and I'm sorry that I didn't watch it because I probably contributed to this happening. Sorry.
Speaking about contributing to this thing happening, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Don't bereft and heartbroken. Come on, man.
When you get your own game time, you can decide what the transition is.
I will.
Yeah. All right, everybody. This is, in fact, the first game time of the season. Woo! The season scores are zero for everybody. Woo! Guys, it's time to cash in your Dave points. Dave point cash in time. I hope you've been keeping accurate record of your Dave points.
Yes.
All right, Tara, please tell me how many Dave points you have.
7.
How many Dave points does Sarah have?
60.
Wow. All right. And how many Dave points does our value guests have?
Also 7.
All right. So that means that Tara and the value guests will get 2 vampire kisses. Wait for it. And Sarah will get, like, let's just say 10. I'm giving Sarah 10. Vampire. Okay. And this is what a vampire kiss is. It works a little bit like a steel meal. But after a player gets their question but doesn't say anything, you yell, blah. And if they get it wrong, you get the points.
Okay.
Wait. Say that again?
After I ask the question, but before anybody else answers, this is when somebody else is playing.
Right. Then
if
I just
you yell, blah, you activate the vampire's kiss. And that's all you need to do. If they answer incorrectly, those points that they would have are transferred to your coffers.
Okay.
Coffer-insers.
Dude, yes, these vampire kisses expire today or do they persist?
They will persist. They are immortal.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Like the vampire.
How many does Sarah have?
2 for you.
Yeah.
2 for value guest, 10 for Sarah.
10? Okay.
Yes.
So our
That's why you try to appease me at every moment. She's got 10 kisses now.
Yeah, yeah. So are all our Dave points now wiped out?
All Dave points are now reset.
Reset to 0. Okay.
Yes. Nobody has Dave points. We've all been converted into vampire kisses.
Okay, I have one more question about the vampire kiss. So it's not like a steal meal where you're I'm just stealing the points if they get it right. I'm not stealing the question, right?
No, if they get it wrong.
Oh.
Once again, here is the workflow.
Sorry.
This is the third time, but
okay,
here we go.
Okay, I'm listening.
I ask a question to somebody else. It is not your turn.
Yes.
If you think they're going to get it wrong, you enact Vampire Kiss by yelling, blah.
Okay, before
they
answer.
That's all you do. Silence! Let me finish the explanation. If they get it wrong, you get those points.
Oh, okay, got it.
Jesus H. Christ, I regret everything about this Vampire Kiss thing already.
No!
But today we are playing Selective Effective Objective Detective from Mademoiselle Caroline, who earns herself an extra credit topic of her choosing. She writes, can you guess the name of a TV detective thanks to an awkwardly rhyming riddle? That's all there is to it. I'm going to read you tell me the name of the TV detective. Sometimes that will also be the name of the show, obviously, but the answer we want is the name of the detective.
Okay.
Tara, can I please get a steel meal and vampire kiss report?
Okay, thank you. This was my next question. Sarah DeBunting has 13 steel meals. I have 12. The valued guest has 10 plus Eric's meal. So 11.
Wow.
And vampire kisses. Let's remind everybody.
And the vampire kisses. Sarah has 10. I have 2. Uh-huh. Brittany has 2.
Yeah.
Or Brittany / valued guest.
Okay, here we go. Let's sort of picky to see who is going to go first.
Okay. This is going
to
be chaos.
I swear to God, Helen.
We'll start with Sarah.
All right, our order today. Sarah, Tara, Brittany. Are we ready to play Selective, Effective, Objective Detective?
Let's see.
I hope so.
Probably.
Okay, here we go. I will read you the riddle. You just name me the detective or detectives in question. Here we go, Sarah. They are wealthy, they are glamorous. They delve in crimes which can be very clamorous. They love to love and love to play and come home to Max and Freeway.
Blah.
There we go. Tara has enacted the vampire's kiss. If Sarah gets this wrong, 1 point to Tara.
I was actually going to test whether I could vampire kiss myself and get a point. No? Okay.
They are wealthy, they are glamorous, they delve in crimes which can be very clamorous. They love to love and love to play and come home to Max and Freeway. Any idea who's the detective? There's 2 detectives there, obviously.
2 detectives. Rizzoli and Isles.
Incorrect. Tara, with the point, because the answer there was
Heart to Heart
is the show. That's Jennifer and Jonathan Hearts. I would have just accepted the Hearts. All right, here we go. It is time for Tara's first riddle.
Okay.
Fancy mustaches and elegant clothes so swell. A passion for order and justice as well. Even in pre-war England, so many killers, can't you tell? So beware of murderers of his little gray cells.
Oh, Poirot.
Poirot is correct. All right, Brittany, here you go. Oh, she does not enjoy the prospects.
No, I'm like, I'm nervous.
Okay, here we go. Here we go. This badly dressed lieutenant can be so annoying with his constant questions and cigar smoking. Almost rhymes. But don't underestimate him, because one more thing, he'll prove to you who did the killing.
Columbo?
Columbo, yes. Hey! There you go. See?
That's so, I know that one. I love.
There you go.
I love Columbo.
Back to Sarah. She's mysterious, deadpanned, and tough. She loves ballet and Nancy Meyers stuff. She loves her bike and her friends well enough. But watch out, thugs, because she can be rough. TV detective.
Gonna be annoyed with myself. Is it Bones?
Bones? No, it is not Bones. We were looking for anybody.
Rosa Diaz from
Rosa
Brooklyn
Diaz 99. From Brooklyn 99. Correct.
Oh, okay.
Oh. All right, Tara.
Yep.
This fake soothsayer drives Caroline to distraction. 80s movies and crime solving move him to action. Ugh. But wait for it. His friendship with Gus is the real attraction.
The fuck is his name? It's the guy.
I'll accept
from
first name only for this one.
No, it's Syke Sykington. I don't know his name.
Syke Sykington.
I don't remember his name.
Almost correct. It is not Gus. It is Sean Spencer.
Sean.
From
Sean.
Syke.
I'm sorry, Caroline.
Now the question is: are the guys from Supernatural detectives?
Hmm.
If so, they'll definitely be in this game. I'm gonna guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Brittany. In Bay City, these buddies are on the case. In the red Grand Torino, the baddies they chase. Bell-bottom jeans and white cardigans they do wear. Their informant is a stylish man named Huggy Bear.
Say that one more time.
In Bay City, these buddies are on the case. In their red Grand Torino, the baddies they chase. Bell-bottom jeans and white cardigans they do wear. Their informant is a stylish man named Huggy Bear.
The name Huggy Bear I recognize, but I don't think I know who everybody else is. Mod Squad?
Mod Squad. Well, you're in the right general
you're
chunk
the
of
zone.
The universe.
Yeah.
But the answer there is Starsky and Hutch, Detectives Starsky and Hutch, also the name of the show. All right, back to Sarah D. Bunting. Short shorts and a mustache worn with style. Avoiding Higgins, Zeus, and Apollo with guile. In a red Ferrari, he can't always avoid disasters, and he can't seem to prove who is Robin Masters.
It's Magnum.
It's Magnum, correct. 1 point. Tara.
Finally. Yep.
If you ask me, it doesn't make sense at all that so many killers live in a town so small. The murder she solves and the sheriff buys it, but it seems more likely that she's the real culprit.
Jessica Fletcher from Murder, She Wrote.
Yes. Nice. I try to sell it when I can, but yeah. Sometimes it's a little.
She said in the description that it's awkwardly rhymed, so.
We got what was on the tin.
That's
expectations
right.
Met.
Scansion.
All right. Brittany, when your best friend is killed, go gumshoe. But while going to high school, too. With her dad's help, there's nothing she can't do except find her happily ever after with her surfer boo.
Veronica Mars.
Veronica Mars is correct. Yes. Sarah D. Bunting.
Yep.
Ripped from the headlines, plots, and offenders galore. Her adoptive son's storyline was a bore. Her original partner's butt sure made me smile. She's been in our screens for quite a while.
She sure has. Marhar superstar, that is Olivia Benson.
Yes, from Law & Order SVU, correct.
I agree about the butt, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tara.
Yeah.
Roses are red, violets are blue. Your wife and daughter are dead, so work for the CBI, do you?
Jack Bauer?
No.
Oh!
Incorrect. The answer we were looking for is Patrick Jane from The Mentalist.
The Mentalist.
Oh.
All right, Brittany. This guy was racist, violent, and drunk. But that's how you get Emmys in your trunk. But it's okay, folks. Deep down, he has a heart of gold. Although his shower butt left us all cold.
Shower butt?
Shower butt.
He was racist and mean?
I'll read it again for you. This guy was racist, violent, and drunk, but that's how you get Emmys in your trunk. But it's okay, folks. Deep down, he has a heart of gold. Although his shower butt left us all cold.
I don't know. I don't know that one.
Steel meal?
Yep.
The former Beverly Hills Bunts, actually, Sipowicz?
Yes, Alan Sipowicz from NYPD Blue, correct. Nicely done. All right, let's throw it to the score break person. That's Tara. You're the score break person.
It's very close. Brittany has 2 points. Sarah and I are tied with 3 each.
All right, I think that's about the halfway mark. Don't quote me on that.
Okay.
I don't have a spreadsheet today. Today is just pure text. So here we go. Back to Sarah DiBundi.
Yeah.
I can feel it coming in the air tonight with pastel colored shirts and suits so white. He lives on a yacht on a vice cop's pay, but he comes home to his pet alligator at the end of the day.
Do I get any extra points for naming the alligator?
Yes.
Okay. It's Sonny Crockett and the alligator's name is Elvis.
Yes, correct. All right. I'll give you a day point for the,
Racking him back
for
up.
The Elvis. Yeah.
Tally resumes.
Playing the long game, guys. Yeah. All right, back to Tara Ariano.
Yes.
Who crew might be more charismatic? Two cutie pies and two friends quite dramatic. But all they do is run away from ghosts is problematic. She sees through the monster's lies, and that's fantastic.
Can you read that again? Sorry.
Her crew might be more charismatic.
Yeah.
Two cutie pies and two friends quite dramatic.
Yeah.
But all they do is run away from ghosts is problematic. She sees through the monster's lies, and that's fantastic.
Well, since she says two cutie pies, I'm going to guess that Daphne and Fred and say Velma. Although Velma is also cute.
Yes, correct.
Rude.
Take it up with Caroline. Mm-hmm. Brittany. Mm-hmm. In New York, crime they do smother. One's a career-driven lady, the other a mother. Two female leads on an 80s cop show that felt quite glass-ceiling shattering a long time ago.
Cagney and Lacey?
Yes, Cagney and Lacey are your detectives there. Back to Sarah. It's a jungle out there when you have serious OCD. So many quirks and phobias, you can't be in the Frisco PD. So you're a consultant because your mind is still the best, even when criminals put your afflictions to the test.
Adrian Monk.
Adrian Monk is correct. Dar.
Yep.
This period sleuth Dan Cassino adores. During the war, he investigated on the British shores. Although far from our time, cops today should look and listen to this upstanding and open-minded cop played by Michael Kitchen.
Morse? I know that's not right. We watched one for the friggin' canon.
Say it again. I didn't hear.
Morse.
Morse? No, that is not correct.
Not Bobby
Steel Quinn. Mill.
Steel Mill from Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah.
Foyle.
Christopher Foyle's from Foyle's War. Ugh. Yes. That is Foyle. Correct.
I and watched the whole series and
F
loved
Oil.
It. AMA.
In my opinion.
F Oil. Yeah.
If I start to stutter and pass out, it's because one of our dogs just let go of the world's worst fart. And I'm actually starting to tear up here.
That almost rhymed. Art. Out.
I'll allow it. I'll
dog,
allow it.
As we say in our household, dog.
Dog fart.
Fart. Horror. Okay. Brittany. This guy's a writer and a ladies' man. His books are crime fiction, but help the real police he can. Although the female detective resisted his charms at the start, it must be said that eventually he won her heart.
Say it one more time?
Yes. This guy is a writer and a ladies' man. His books are crime fiction, but help the police he can. Though the female detective resisted his charms at the start, it must be said that he eventually won her heart.
Oh, I have no idea.
Steel Mill
from Tara.
Castle.
Castle, yes. She says meekly, barely audible. Castle.
Castle.
Sarah D. Bunting, everybody has one question left, so let's get the scores before we do that. Ba-da-da-da-da.
It's still quite close. Brittany has 3. I have 5. Sarah is our leader with 6.
All right, here we go. Sarah D. Bunting. If you get this, I guess you clinch it.
No, maybe. Mm.
For Tara, where he's concerned, it's off with his pants. With a southern drawl and a Stetson he enchants. Metering justice, always a hard liner, except when dealing with his fellow coal miner.
Oh. what is that motherfucker's name though? Raylan Givens.
Raylan Givens is correct. Yes.
For fun. Yes. Let's right, say that.
Here's your last one.
Okay.
This entomologist is awkward in social situations, but he introduced us to forensic investigations.
He did.
Although in the end, he and Sarah were together, we all know his true love was Lady Heather.
That's Gil Grissom from CSI.
Yes, that Aww. Is. And Brittany's last question. Mm-hmm. It's hard to be an efficient FBI investigator when you're confronted with a supernatural hater. Cherry pie and black coffee can only take you so far when all the town folks are just so bizarre.
No, I can't remember his name.
Talk it out. What show? Maybe it'll help.
It's Twin Peaks.
Mm, perhaps.
You said cherry pie.
I can't give you that answer. I'm just saying, I think it might be.
It is Twin Peaks. It might be.
By the way, just an aside while you're thinking about that. Sarah, what kind of car did you just get? And what did you name it?
I just got a Mini Cooper.
Ooh, Mini Cooper's a good
I
car.
And I named it DB. Yeah.
Dale Cooper?
Yay!
Yay! Twin Peaks, yay! That's good!
All right, let's get the final scores, please, Sarah.
Everyone finished strong. Brittany has 4. I have 6. Sarah, our victress, with 7.
All right, 7. Thank you, Vampire Kiss. Mwah! Ah!
Sarah.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We fell in line for Fox's Domino Masters before going around the dial with stops at Winning Time. I can't wait for God to play point guard on the Lakers. Survivor, Euphoria, Top Chef, and Fast Foodies. Tara gave Rami a lift with her successful cannon pitch. We crowned winners and losers of the week. And Sarah was the winner of this week's Game Time from Mademoiselle Caroline. Next up, it's Kate's on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's the Listener Game Time Tournament. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
just being petty per fucked up.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Mom, it's overtime. I can't control that.
And Brittany Luce.
I'm ready to topple the patriarchy.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Hey, actually, could you just drop me off here to the left?
We still have 7 minutes.
It's okay. Here's good.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.